sorry about that. Lesson one. I forgot to put it on tape. Thank you for putting that. So in lesson one, from Ezra 1 through 3, we're really looking then at the backstory. We need to understand the backstory so that we understand what's going on and we don't miss some of the meaning in there. So the backstory will help us understand what is going on and what we need to cultivate awareness of. So through Ezra, through Nehemiah, through Haggai, we'll look at a couple different things. But in Ezra particularly, we are trying to be aware of how God is restoring the heart of Israel. How he's first of all looking at their heart. And how that's what he's been doing. He's been restoring their heart. And so just like when we look at Mayor Pradel and seeing his wife in a wheelchair. By the way, she's there in a wheelchair not just to listen to him. She's actually there to introduce him. She's going to give the introduction to his last speech. And so we understand the emotion of that and we connect with that emotion. You should do that in the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. We should be able to connect with the emotion because the first thing God is doing is getting at the heart of these people. He's restoring their heart. He's got to pay attention to their heart first before he can restore anything else in Israel and before Israel can become restored and full as models of his image. So there are three things that in Ezra 1 through 3 we really want to take a look at and become more aware of. And mostly, when we're talking about cultivating awareness, it's cultivating the awareness that life is a gift. That all of life is a gift. So not just the big idea of life as a gift, but the little idea of today, this is a gift. So Lisa walks in here and she's in the midst of demolition. And she should be able to connect with the feeling that this is a gift. To be in a mess, to be in the middle of the rubble is a gift. If you're going through something really tough, there's something right now going on in your life that isn't in your picture that you had all along, God wants you to understand the backstory of this is part of the gift I'm giving you. This is actually necessary for you to get that full restoration. So in seeing life as a gift, there's really three components that Ezra is going to talk about. So we have chapter one talking about seeing the gift of the hope of restoration. So the hope of restoration is actually what keeps us going, right? If Lisa didn't think that they would ever be finished remodeling the home, she would have no hope. And having no hope pretty much stops us in our tracks, right? Mm-hmm. We are done and we don't move. So that it's hope that actually pulls us forward. And we know that when scripture talks about hope, hope is not something that might happen. Hope is about believing the thing that is absolutely going to happen. We just don't see it, right? What's the definition in Hebrews of hope?
The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
Yes. Hope is the evidence of things unseen. So the hope of restoration for Israel in Ezra 1 is something they absolutely know for sure is going to happen because God's promised that they're going to be restored. And he's given them the specific words, I'm going to restore you. We've had those same words spoken to us in Genesis 3. I am restoring you. I am restoring you. So you do have hope. So all believers have hope. All people in the world have hope. They just don't know that perhaps this is a truth that's going to happen. So the hope of restoration is actually a big, big deal for the Jews here and for us as well. So being aware, though, of the hope of restoration, being aware of the fact that we're in the middle of restoration, is going to make a big difference in how we engage in the world and how we engage with God's presence. Is the hope of restoration. So that's the first thing that Ezra is going to show us that we need cultivating is the awareness of the hope of restoration. In chapter 2, we're going to look at the fact that there is a gift, not only in the hope of restoration, but there's a gift in community. That community is actually a gift. And even if you are a super introvert, even Michelle and Karen and myself, community is a gift. And for us, that some of us, for the introverts, that's a little bit harder for us to see. For the extroverts, they're like, well, of course. Who doesn't know that community is a gift? Right? They're like, yeah, of course. And you can always tell that by questions we ask, right? So remember the question we asked going through the Oriental Museum, would you rather be, what was the question?
Popular or smart? Popular.
And the people, each of the people who answered were like, well, popular, of course. And the rest of us were like, well, smart, of course. And we look at each other like, really?
Seriously?
You'd rather be popular or smart? Are you kidding me? And they're looking at us like...
And we're looking at the sexual pieces in the museum laughing, and you're like looking at the intellectual things.
So true. And yet, even that wouldn't have been fun without community, right? So for us introverts who would much rather be smart than popular, no, down deep, we're actually made for relationships, so we actually do crave that. We wouldn't say that. Right?
We're just making you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Sometimes I still like, really? Okay. So the gift of community is what we're going to see in that really strange chapter of chapter 2. You're thinking, are you kidding me? We have to study chapter 2. All it is a list of people. Right? But we're going to look at the few verbs in there, and it's about community. So the gift of the hope of restoration is something we need to cultivate awareness of. But we also need to cultivate awareness of the gift of community. It is necessary for restoration. Without community, there is no restoration. So in Western Christianity, we've talked about it all being about our relationship with God. There's no such thing. There is only a relationship with God and others. There is no such thing as a relationship with God and me. It doesn't exist. We can try to make it happen, but it won't be a relationship with God. Because it's always about community. Because remember, we talked about this a million times. God is Trinitarian. We're in his image. We're Trinitarian. It's us, God, and others. That's the wholeness. So the gift of the hope of restoration, the gift of community. And thirdly, in chapter 3, we're going to look at the gift of worship. They come around an altar there, and the gift of worship and the necessity of worship to put us in a place that's ready for restoration. So that's kind of where we're going. I give you that big picture because I know we're not going to get through it all, so we'll just go from there. So in chapter 1, we have, tell me what the story is in chapter 1. What's going on?
Cyrus was stirred.
Who was Cyrus?
King of Persia,
right? Why do we care about the king of Persia?
That's where the exiles were.
Okay.
God stirred his heart to do his work.
Okay, but right, that's where the exiles were. They were under the king of Persia. Remembering that Persia was one of the biggest empires. It was the biggest empire up until that time. So this guy has a lot of power. He basically has the world power. He's as powerful as the United States has been. Probably more so, actually. So it's important that we know that Cyrus's heart was stirred by God.
I feel like it's funny because, like, from the beginning of the story, I think God's been trying to show us that, like, he is God of all. Yes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And he, like, moves in all cultures and all
people, you know?
And when the whole, we were talking in our group about the word stirring coming up and all that kind of stuff. It just makes me think how sometimes we're like, okay, our president has to be a Christian or has to be,
right.
God can stir any heart.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's like amazing when you look at it, you're like, they probably were not even happy.
Right.
That God was like,
right. It's, that's
you can only
work
through us.
Yeah, exactly. That's
not
exactly
just,
it.
Like, this Persian Empire, yep. You know. Yep. Anyways, just
yeah, funny. And that's exactly the getting to the deeper part, right? Mm-hmm. The meaning of God not only can but does stir whomever he wants to be able to accomplish his restoration. Mm-hmm. And remember, the backstory is restoration. He has told them that he was going to restore them. And here's the interesting thing. In Jeremiah, and she'll get you a little bit into Jeremiah, but boy, if you get time to read Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Zechariah, it'll really tell you about like what God was doing. Really, even more of the backstory. The fact is, 150 years before Cyrus ever comes to power, 150 years, what happened 150 years ago here? Can you even remember? But no. In our life, right? It's a long time. 150 years for a people. 150 years ago, God had told Jeremiah, tell the people, first, they're going into exile. But tell them they're also coming out of exile. And they're coming out under a Persian king named Cyrus. Okay, there was no Persia at the time. 150 years before, there was no Persia. There was no such kingdom. There was no king named Cyrus. There was nothing. There was the Assyrians and the Babylonians. That's it. God already said, look, this is my story. Remember, I'm restoring you. I have this great love for you. And this is how it's going to go. So that each day of their lives, in the hardship that was coming, they could say, this is part of God's restoration. This is part of God's restoration. This too is restoration. So that's what's happening here. And what we need to understand is God is very serious about his holiness. God is very serious about your holiness. And when we talk about holiness, I want us to get rid of the idea that holiness means perfection. Holiness really means whole. God is very serious about restoring us to who he created us to be. He's very serious about restoring us to being image bearers, to being in cohort, in Trinitarian relationship. He's very serious about that. Serious enough to even say, this is my plan. I'm going to exile you. And the fact that he's going to exile is a good thing, is part of his seriousness about making you whole. So going back to, why in the world was he going to exile them? Why was he going to push them out of the country, out of the land that he'd given them to be a model?
To get their attention.
Yeah.
Desire.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So what was the reason they needed to get out of there?
To create that desire.
But what?
They had forgotten about God.
They forgot about God, right. They had become idolatrous, right? They had centered their lives around getting life for themselves in other ways. Mm-hmm. Did it mean they pushed God completely out of their lives? Nope. He was still around. They still said he was the center. But they intermarried, right? So that they made covenants. They said, there are other things that can fulfill me. I'm going after other things that can satisfy me. So idolatry is really believing that somebody else or something else can fulfill you, can make you whole. You know, I hate the fact that we now have movie lines that say this, right? What's a famous movie line that says this?
You complete me.
See? You complete me, right? And everybody knows that line. And we hear that. And this is what society says. It's somebody else that's going to complete me. Some people say, oh, no, it's not going to be somebody else. It's going to be if I'm successful, right? If I have a certain amount of wealth, if I have things. Those are all idolatrous ways because we say that somebody or something else can make us full and whole. It ruins every relationship, right? When we believe that someone can make us whole and can complete us. It's not true. It can never happen. Go ahead and try it. And that's basically what God says, right? You go ahead and try, and we'll see what happens. But the problem is when you try, because you have been set up as my model as to who I am, you are a reflection of who I am, you try long enough, and I'm going to need to knock you down. I'm going to need to get you out of the way because you are spreading a lie about me. You're saying that I actually are not the only source of fulfillment. You're saying, perhaps, and this would be the case for us, you're saying, well, yeah, God can fulfill you, but so can other things. Or God and something. God and a great ministry, right? God and being great to the poor. So we can put in lots of good things, right? This will fulfill you. And God says, you're telling a lie about me. Because I am the only one who can make you complete. Because if what you are, if your identity is image bearer, the only thing that can make you a complete image bearer is that you're connected to what you're bearing image of. I'm the only one who can make you complete. And so, he's going to have to knock you down. Because you have disregarded his presence as central to life, you're distorting his image, and therefore he needs to exile you. He needs to get you out of the way so that, number one, you're in a place where you're not spreading the lie. You're in a place where it's hard for you to experience his presence. He actually wants that in sometimes in your life, for you to be in a place where it's hard to experience his presence. Why would he want that?
Creating yearning.
Yes, creating yearning. Creating that desire and finding that you can't make that experience happen. You can't fix it. You can't fix yourself. You can't fix the people around you. You can't fix your situation. He wants you to be in those positions sometimes, so that you actually reorient. What does the word orient mean?
Mm-hmm.
To face his presence, right? Mm-hmm. It means to face Jerusalem. It's actually what the word means. He wants us to reorient ourselves and to face him. So he needs to put us into a place of exile. And a place of exile is a place where things all of us, you're taking out of your routine. So anytime that you are taken out of your routine, it's an exile. It's an exile that God says, okay, you don't know what's going on and you don't know how to handle this. That's where I want you, because I want you to turn to me because you can't handle it. I want you to be in a place where you actually discover your own heart. That your heart is exposed and you realize that the center of your heart was all about your picture getting done. The way that you thought life should be, this is what it looks like. I want to slow you down so that you begin to become aware of the fact that I'm restoring you. And I'm going to do it no matter what choices you make. I'm going to still restore you, and I'm going to use exactly those choices to do that.
I have a story.
Yes.
Whenever you
go ahead.
Want me to jump in here. Okay, so this is kind of cool because I have never really thought about it in this situation, and it's just really, I feel like it's mirroring what you're talking about. So my dad and his wife have been coming to stay with us at our lake cottage for probably 10 summers. He'll come for a month or two in the summer and live with my family, and they live in Florida the rest of the year. And my dad would definitely say that he loves God, he prays for me all the time, but when he would come in the summers, he refuses to go to church with us. And with my kids, for years, we would invite him, and finally we just stopped inviting. Big fight happens, whatever. But this past summer, my dad and his wife were there, and over the 10 years, he's kind of developed a community with my husband's in-laws and my husband's family and other people at the lake. So we had already come back to Naperville, and he's riding his bike around the lake, which is his adopted one-month community, right? That he doesn't seem to do anything spiritual, right? And he notices a family that has no roof. I mean, it looks like it should be condemned. And I had seen it myself and thought, oh, we should do something about that, and didn't do anything. My dad, who is a very outgoing guy, walks right up to the door and says, I would like to get your roof restored or fix your roof, right? And she's like, well, we just don't have money for it or whatever. He's like, I'll raise the money for it. And she's like, okay, you know, doesn't really believe him. My dad sends out emails and talks to everybody at the lake. And he's a sales guy, okay? So he's talking to everybody he knows. And he raises about $5,000. And he finds somebody he golfs with that's going to do the work. And he goes to Home Depot and finds out that there's a discount for people who are veterans. I mean, like, he does all this legwork. This is not my dad. My dad's like a golfer who sits in front of the TV all the time. But it was so interesting because he got so much joy out of that this fall. Got the roof finished. We sent him pictures, you know, all done. And he got a letter from her at Christmas time about how she was an answer to prayer and that she's thanking God for him. And I've never seen my dad so fulfilled, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just so interesting because, like, I can see how he found community. I can see how he did what he was made for, right? Yeah. He restored. He brought people together to do it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have money to just slap down the $5,000, but he found, you know, people to come together, and it brought a lot of joy to all of us. And yeah. so it's just so interesting to see how God's working in him in a different way than I imagined.
You know? Right, and it wasn't your picture.
No.
And you thought if you went to church, that would make him...
Well, there is community there.
Which is... almost in the Christian community, it's like one of the first questions we ask, right?
Yeah,
like, well, are you going to church? Really? Mm-hmm. Is that really the question we need to be asking?
But it is a place of community.
It is a place of community.
True. Yeah, right. It can be.
If it's your choice.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. If you're guilted into it, it's not going to be a place of community.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see, if we're looking at the backstory, that God is restoring everyone and giving them the opportunity in every single thing that's happening, whether they're walking into a car or they're having a celebration of a marriage, God is restoring here. That's the backstory. God's loving them into restoration in one way or another. And for us, then, when we say, oh, yeah, I want that, and then yet distort his image by saying, but I'm going to get fulfillment in other places. He needs to bring us to a place that we understand that our assumptions about life need to be shaken up. And that we need to see rather than just this seeing. Cultivating an awareness is different than believing or doing. And we don't talk about this seeing much, but it's all over Scripture about being able to see that God is actually working here and restoring. Because without seeing it, sometimes believing is a little bit shallow. And doing can be really shallow. Unless we understand the backstory of this is restoring, this is restoration. Whatever's happening now is restoration. So we need to understand that there's hope of restoration because God has promised it, and it's not something that's going to happen. And this is another, I think, faulty way of thinking we've had, right? So many times we talk about in the church, I can't wait, well, it used to be when I was growing up, can't wait for the rapture. Of course, now I've kind of shown you that that's a little bit skewed, how we've looked at that. I can't wait for that point. And I still hear people say, I can't wait for heaven because then I'll be restored, right? Then I'll be whole. This is sad because God's saying, you're ignoring what I'm doing now? I'm restoring you now. Like right now, this minute, I'm restoring you. And you don't care about that. You're disregarding my presence in your center, in your heart. And you're waiting for my presence somewhere else. It's like that race. Like, he's there at the end. He's just waiting. He's not. He's not at the end. The end isn't a truth. Here is the truth.
So even though we are in the world and we have these bodies that are, you know, degrading and going down, mm-hmm. It's the verse about, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day.
Yep, that's exactly what that is.
It's
yep.
inward.
Yep.
Isn't Jesus the example of
yes.
a fully restored relationship as fully man?
Yes, and fully man. Mm-hmm. So, and this is the other thing too. We always think about us getting new bodies as if we this body is gone completely. Mm-hmm. No, he's restoring this body. Mm-hmm. He will restore this body to wholeness, and it will be like, oh boy, we could talk so much into that because of who Jesus was and what he did. Guys, that's full humanity. It wasn't divinity you were seeing. Remember, he placed his divinity on the side. Mm-hmm. What you see in Jesus is humanity fully restored. Mm-hmm. That's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. It's why I ask you about questions about restoring, because when you get a picture of what it looks like, right? So diets, right? Diets are big in January. And what are the pictures always? Like trying to get you in for some kind of a diet.
Before and after.
A before and after picture, right? And why do they give you those?
So you can identify with. Or
yeah, like.
There's a result.
Wow, I could look
shame.
Like that? Yeah. Shame. Yeah, well, yeah, that could be too. Yeah.
That's so funny you brought that. I said to my husband in our closet this morning, I'm like, well, January's almost over. And here we are, 10 years. And we gained weight. You know, it's getting worse.
And the good news is that God is actually making progress with us. And that picture of who Jesus is, who we see Jesus, when Jesus is dividing that bread and he's giving it to those people, guess what? That's what we're getting restored to. We're getting restored to who Jesus was. And if that's your picture, that hope is huge. Like, oh, you need to sand down the rust today to get me there? Go at it. And it doesn't mean when you're standing on that rust, you don't go, that hurts. It means you say that, but it also means that really hurts. Keep going.
But didn't right? he show up with his restored body? I mean, isn't that what happened after he was resurrected and he was walking around?
Ah, then we get the full.
Do you know what I mean? And I think we think of it as a better body instead of like a yes, freer body.
That and that's
you know
exactly
what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Like, exactly. So it's, and it's, and yeah, that's another, when we go there again, what I want us to understand is this hope of restoration propels us. We need to keep in mind the backstory so that we understand when we're going through hard times and when we're going through really easy, restful times, we understand that that's part of the restoration process and where we're going in that restoration process. So we understand that exile is part of the restoration process, mm-hmm. but that he's promised that exile isn't forever, that it's coming around. And so now we're in that place where they're actually being brought back and they can see his faithfulness. They become aware of his faithfulness because when Cyrus issues this decree, when they hear it, you're right. Number one, they're going, well, wait. A pagan king is going to tell us this? And I think back into my life, there have been pagans who have actually issued decrees in my life that have been part of the process. I did not grow up in a believing family, and yet because of some of their pagan ways, because of prejudices, they sent me to a Christian high school. I was already a Christian, and I have this trepidation of, wow, I get to go to a Christian school. Oh my gosh, I have to go to a Christian school. I'm going to have to wear, I've told you this story before, right? I'm going to have to wear very drab clothing. The first day of school, I wore a gray suit. This was 1972. By the time I graduated, I was wearing miniskirts. Two. Those miniskirts, they're called scissors. You had to wear panties with them because they were so short.
Do
we
have a dress code there?
Do you
not wear panties
not
with the longer
ones? Matching
panties.
Yeah, matching
panties. She's trying to make friends with me.
It didn't work. See, smart is much easier. So yeah, they had some trepidation that it's Cyrus who's telling this, but they also go, wait, I think a long time ago God said something about this. God's bringing us back. And it's interesting that so we have them going back to Jerusalem, but we don't have them all going back. So we'll look at that in chapter 2. But what we see is not just God's faithfulness, we also, they became aware of God's power. Wow. He doesn't just display his power here with us in our little community that we've made in Babylonia. He's displaying it in the world. It's not even just Cyrus and that royal court there in Susa, he was displaying it to the world because everyone actually got to see them come back. The interesting thing is, and we forget this when we read scripture, they weren't the only people that Cyrus actually let go back home. This was a brand new way of doing kingdom. And so God is powerful enough to actually change paradigms. Persia, and that thought, was never anywhere in the world. Persia comes along, and Cyrus, being the first king of Persia, decides, I think the best way to rule other people is to let them go home. So he lets lots of people go home. So we see this all over. We look at the Jews and go, yeah, but my God is behind that. And behind that is God restoring us to being his models, his images, so that they see his faithfulness and they see his power. But they had to see it. They had to look at that. They had to have their heart exposed. Well, we haven't made him the center. They knew, Jeremiah had told them, and they knew the reason they were in exile. They knew it was their idolatry. And they knew the idolatry started with, and this will play into the rest of the story, they knew their idolatry started with making covenants with foreign women, right? Marrying into foreign women's families. So they have their heart exposed, but then they get to see God's heart, that he actually has been faithful the whole time, that he's been working it the whole time, that he's been actually using history. And one thing we forget is history is God's tool. It's not something that just happens on its own and God like comes into it. History is actually a tool that God uses. And if history, big history here, is the tool God uses, your history is also a tool God uses. So, Karen, you and I didn't grow up in believing homes, right? God's using that. God uses that as a tool for us. Whatever you grew up with, God's using that. It's part of your backstory, but it's part of God's backstory as well. He is using that history. It's his tool. It's not something apart from God. And he can stir hearts. And the thing about the stirring of the heart, that the word stirring there actually means to wake up, to actually to open the eyes, to have the eyes open. So have you ever been asleep after a really hard day and someone comes in and turns on the light and opens the blinds and says, good morning! And you're like, no, right? You get that choice. Remember that God's rule and power is always a vulnerable power. God has chosen to be a vulnerable God and say, I'm going to do everything I can to say this is a good thing to do. It's a good morning to wake up. It's a good time to wake up, but I'm not going to force you. So when it says he stirred Cyrus's heart, he didn't force Cyrus. Just like he didn't force Pharaoh. He gave them the opportunity, and he said, hey, I'm opening your eyes. I'm waking you up and say, it's a good morning. And Cyrus could have said no, but he didn't. And we're going to see what Cyrus does. It looks just like what an image bearer does. But he also did that with the Jews. And we really realize it when we realize that only a minority came back, that most of the Jews stayed in Babylon. There's some really interesting history about the fact that most of the Jews stayed in Babylon. It's actually where most of the Talmudic and Midrashic underpinnings of Judaism stayed in Babylon. So interesting.
Because of comfort?
They had completely established lives there, right? They were living in a kingdom that had given them pretty much freedom to remain who they were. And remember, they held on to their identity. We talked about that last week. So that if you go back into some of the original manuscripts of that time, they mention Jews along with everybody else as if they're as upstanding citizens. So they have completely assimilated into, we've made comfortable lives here. This is where our family is. And remember, by this time, it's more than a generation past. Most of the people have never seen Jerusalem, right? It's not quite 70 years yet. It's about 50 at this point that they're going back. We'll talk about timeline. We'll talk about timeline. It will get to be 70. This is just the beginning. when we get into Haggai, we'll get into 70.
So,
okay.
Jill,
yeah.
When you say that Cyrus had the choice, that Jerry said to Jeremiah that in 150 years the Persian kingdom Cyrus will exile. Mm-hmm. Hasn't God already in his providence started that wheel of motion? So
yep.
I mean, even though you say Cyrus had the choice, that choice was already done.
Now we can get into that, but remember it's one coin, two sides.
Okay.
And this is where we, you know, talk about how do we live non-dualistically, right? Mm-hmm. How do we say yes and? Yep, God had made the choice. Yep, Cyrus had a choice.
Yeah.
Right? That happens all the time in our lives, but we sometimes have a hard time when we put that down on paper. But yes, that's true. But Cyrus did have a choice, and God had already chosen. Both are true. Okay? So we have this happening.
My friend is like a psychologist, like says that you can even see that right now. Like,
yes.
Someone can tell you their story, and then you can tell, you can essentially know what they're going to do next.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So there's like that.
There
you
is.
Know what I mean?
All seeing, he knows what Cyrus is going to choose. Because he's of all time. He is of no time.
But I'm saying you could know your kids so well that you know exactly what they do in a situation.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
Kind of
yeah. But, and again, that's a theological discussion we can have, but then we won't get anywhere else. So, what is happening is Israel is becoming aware of the hope of restoration and God's faithfulness and God's power to be able to bring about restoration. And not just to be able to, but that he is doing it. And that he's doing it all the time. He's not waiting for a certain amount of time. He's doing it all the time. So that every day in Babylon was necessary for the restoration. And every day coming out of Babylon is necessary. How then were they to engage in that, and how are we to engage? The first thing they had to do is they had to say, okay, this is my life here. I have a house, and I have children, and I have a job, and I'm well-respected in the community, and I have a way of living. And God is saying, hey, I'm going to restore you. Come on to Jerusalem, that place that has no houses, that is completely devastated. It has no farmland. The farmland has just been destroyed. And there's nothing there. And you have no guarantees. Come on along. What did they need to do? They've cultivated an awareness that God's doing this. So that's their like motivation, right? But now they actually have to do something. And they actually have to turn their back on their life. They actually have to give up that picture of, but life is comfortable here. Life is good. I've really made, and here's the thing. I've really done well here, and I've established myself. What are you hearing? Mm-hmm. I've done this. I've established. Mm-hmm. And God says, do you want to still live that kind of life? Or do you want to live a life where I'm establishing? It means giving up picture, right? Mm-hmm. Again, we got to give up the picture that we have about what's a good life. That we have to give up.
The people who stayed then, they were not obeying the Lord to go back?
Well, you know, Scripture is pretty silent about the people who stay there. In fact, we have very little, even just historical evidence about that. What we do know is they did join in some way. How?
They gave money.
Mm-hmm. One was what they call, it's very interesting, they call voluntary offering. And then it said they gave beyond the voluntary offering. Okay, so voluntary offering, remember, is a name of an offering that they actually gave in sacrifice to God. That was commanded by Cyrus. Cyrus said, all you who are Jews, you are to give a voluntary offering. Again, we've got that, right?
Too voluntary. Yeah.
But beyond that, they gave more, right? So here now we have them leaving Babylon with lots of stuff. Does it remind you of anything?
Yeah.
Leaving Egypt again, right? Yes, God has brought you there. Yes, it was because of you not centering on him. And yes, he's going to restore you again. And he's going to start with giving you. lots of stuff in order for you to be able to make that. So we have to give up our pictures. You got a picture? Mm-hmm. You better right now say, this is my picture. If you don't identify your own picture, you won't give it up. So you have to identify what you say is a good life. And most of us have these pictures of this good life, right? What's a good life? Well, how would we identify a good life?
Healthy.
We're healthy.
Enough money.
Our needs met. We have enough money.
Good relationships.
Good relationships.
Kids are doing great.
Kids are all doing great.
Success,
right? This is a good life. Is it what we were promised?
No.
No. We were promised restoration. Restoration to wholeness. Restoration to image bearing. That's what we've been promised. So you have to identify what you think is a good life. You know, your husband is this way. Your children are this way. Identify that. And then say, I give that up. That's not the picture that I want. My heart really wants restoration. I want to be whole, and I want the rest of my family to be whole, whatever that looks like. Because here's the thing. They understood now that they had to give up their picture, but they had really no idea what they were going toward. They had to stop holding on to the status quo. We have to stop holding on to the status quo. How things are going now, this is good. We have to stop saying, how do I deal with this hard situation so I can get back to normal, right? That's always our idea, right? If something has happened, how do I get back to normal and how do I do it really fast? That's always our idea. It's not God's idea. It's not a question actually we should be asking. Because we're in restoration, we're going to a place we don't know what it looks like. We don't know what that process is going to look like. So stop asking the question, how can I just get back to normal? Because what you're saying is, how can I get back to Egypt? How can I get back to Babylon?
Because of covenant, though, don't we have a comfort that he's good? You know, that's part of our...
And that's the hope of restoration, right?
Yeah.
His goodness is about restoring us for us to be whole. And that's why it's so necessary for us to cultivate the awareness of, oh, he's restoring us. This is good. This is good. It doesn't feel good. But it is good, right? And then they had to submit, right? We have to submit in the midst of the unknown because it is part of a restoration. I have to say, I'm in this. This is restoration. And really, sometimes I think it really helps to say it. Say it out loud. Something's horrible happening and you say, this is restoration. This is the process of restoration. And it brings you back to being aware, to seeing, rather than just believing. This is restoration. Because when you think about restoration, if you've been in any sort of restoration process, you know restoration is messy. Mm-hmm. But it's getting to a point.
Doesn't this happen in our lives like multiple times during the week? I mean,
yes,
I feel like I've
absolutely.
Over again.
This is why understanding the depth of what's going on is important. Understanding, being aware that God's actually working all the time. He's never done, like, oh, I'm done for now and I'll let you. Even in the times of good and rest and joy, those are times of restoration. I always think about, when I think of restoration, I think about a rusty bike. And I think about what would it take to restore that bike or that car. First thing it takes is, right, rubbing off that with a sandpaper, right? And sometimes you got to use the hardest grit. You know, it's hard and it hurts, the bike or the car, if it were me. But there's a point that I've rubbed so much, what do I need to do?
Oil?
Well, before, I mean, look, think about what's happening with the rust.
You've
got to blow it off, right? I got to wash it off. I've got to get some refreshing, right, before I can continue on. So sometimes in your rest times, when things are just going great, that's also restoration. That is God giving you refreshment, blowing off some of that dust that needed to be taken away so he can get back to it. Make sense? Okay. Carolyn, you have...
So I was looking up that word stir, you know, mm-hmm. you were saying to wake up, but it also, like, says to be hot and ardent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was making me think, like, usually most of the time when I wake up, it's because I got hot.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. It was like my body's way, like, you're cool when you're sleeping. Do you know what I mean? Like, your body goes into this, like, cooler temp when you're sleeping. And then when your organs start working and everything, things start warming up.
Or
and
when
then
you're getting
I'm
older,
like,
so right? That's really what you're talking about. Yeah. She doesn't realize that yet, but yeah.
But anyway, yes. I was thinking about what you're talking about. And in some ways, when I get hot and bothered, it's almost like a sign of
yep.
restoration as well.
Yes.
Like if something makes me
yes.
mad,
yes.
it's like, oh, I'm awakening something
right.
here. Something's
yes.
being stirred up.
Yes.
I should probably pay attention.
Yes.
Do you know what
yes.
I mean?
And that is, this. What Ezra, I hope, brings out is beginning to pay attention more and more to what's going on. To what's the story behind this? What is God doing here to restore? So if I stop and say, this is restoration, I also say, this is progress. It's hard, and this is progress. God didn't leave me in Babylon. He's bringing me out. And this is also privilege. For those people, it was a privilege for them to be first, to go and restore and go through all the hardship so that other people could now come back to Jerusalem. Because remember, in the end, everyone will come to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And to have been part of building up, that's a privilege, right? Mm-hmm. That's a huge privilege to remember that. So recognizing the hope of restoration means I cultivate awareness, but I also engage in it. It means I actually have to turn around, stop holding on to the status quo, what's always been, and give up my picture and say, okay, this is restoration. So I ask, where am I being restored? But then I say, I am being restored. Where am I being restored? I am being restored. So it's this conversation of asking God and saying, yep, I am being restored. I accept that as a gift. Yeah, this is a gift. We get into Ezra chapter 2, and it's this list of people. And we think, really, why do we have to have a list of people? We're going to have that same list of people in Nehemiah again. Same list. What we find in Ezra and Nehemiah, there's been a shift in the life of Israel. Because up until now, in Judges, in actually Deuteronomy on through, we've had one big leader, right? And it's all been about that leader bringing the people. We have a shift in Ezra and Nehemiah. And all of a sudden, it becomes about community. It becomes about all the people. And we're actually going to see the leaders here becoming part of the people. So that everyone works together. And we see that community is actually the only way that we can actually be restored. It can't be one leader pulling us along. It has to be all of us together. So to cultivate the awareness of community being necessary for restoration, you'll first need to understand that you are going to be in the minority. It's not going to be everybody. It's not going to be everybody in your family. It's not going to be everybody in your group of friends. It's not going to be everybody in your church. It's going to be a minority of people who actually say, yeah, you woke me up and I'm going to stay awake. I'm going to be aware of God restoring. Because there, remember I said there's a difference between seeing that and believing and doing. So this is a deeper level of commitment that these people make. What you can be sure of, even though it's going to be a minority, it is going to be people who want their hearts restored. It's not people who want a comfortable life. It's not people who are looking for I want to go to church so that I'm a good person. It's, I am a mess and I want to be restored. I am not who I was created to be and I want to be restored. It's people who are willing to submit themselves to being restored. Which means it's going to be a very diverse group. It's going to be a group that is not centered around likes and interests. It's going to be a group who's centered around getting healthy. But in order to get healthy, you have to say, I'm sick. It's going to be people who are committed to having their hearts recentered, to having themselves be exposed and be restored in the midst of community. We need to honor that. We need to honor that in one another. It's really important as you see going along. We need to have some expectancy that there are going to be people who want their hearts restored. And they are most likely the people who look a mess. They're not going to be the people who look put together. If there are people who are put together and they want their heart restored, cracks are going to happen, right? And there's going to be some desire to leave looking put together. And there are going to be people. What you'll notice here in this list in Ezra 2 is we have them kind of in groups. We have the first group is the groups of families. And the second group we talked about are the cities. So groups of cities that are coming back to their certain cities. And then we have the priests and Levites and gatekeepers, which are the ministries. So what is showing us, I mean, in some interesting ways, family, city, ministry. Or what does Matthew say? I'm sending you out into the world so that you go to Jerusalem, Judea, and all the edge of the earth. That's what we're seeing here. That's community. So community, I'm going to be working with people who are very close to me. And when I say family, I mean family of God, not biological family, spiritual family. Family, people who are really close and like in it with you in the restoration process. That being with. The city people are people who you all need to build up the places that you're going to be living. And we'll talk a little bit more about this again. And then we have those in ministry. So those priests and Levites, remember that eventually they'll get into a routine where they'll see each other just occasionally. The ministries only go on for a short time. Don't ever think that a ministry is like, this is it for the rest of my life. I'm always this. It wasn't for them, and it isn't for us. So that it's you know, I'm going to work with these people or not. Remembering that all of these people have committed to letting their hearts be restored, which means you need to honor that, and you also need to deal with them with tenderness, right? They're going to be exposed. They have committed themselves to restoration, but they don't know everything that's going to cost and what that's going to look like. And they don't know how their lives are going to fall apart. We need to treat everyone knowing that the backstory is they're in the middle of restoration, no matter what part of the process they're in. Tenderness in the church is pretty null, I would say. Particularly for people who are going through restoration, right? 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 You've seen that, right? Yes, we see that so often. This is why we need to understand that being aware of what's going on, being aware of God's restoration is so important. Because it talks to our heart. It's where our heart is. And if our heart isn't compassionate toward people going into restoration, then our heart is not centered on God.
Well, and it almost points those sorts of folks to idolatry.
Yes.
Like, oh my gosh, we don't embrace you, so they're desiring restoration, and then they seek something else, and that offers like
yes.
a false
yes.
wholeness. And like
very true. That's so true. And we see it all the time, right? If you look at any of the polls right now, I mean, particularly the younger generation is eschewing church altogether, mm-hmm. and this is one of the reasons, right? There's no compassion, there's no tenderness for being vulnerable and open and saying, yeah, I'm a mess, and that's why I'm here. Oh, no. You got to look really good.
Well, Kristen, I even think if you're, like, I have a close girlfriend that's been going through this, like, awful breakup that she's dated this guy for 4 years, and I feel like I try to speak as much truth into her, and then I'll be like, hey, you want to come to church with me? And she's like, no, that's okay. But then she's, like, hungry for that.
Yes.
But there is something about
right.
going to church with me
right.
that feels
yes.
really threatening to her.
Right, exactly.
And, yeah.
And for us to make that the mark.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Now she's going to church with me.
Right.
No, that isn't the mark, actually.
Right.
Yeah. Are you on the journey? You want to come to the journey? You know, I'm going to come with you. And think about, that journey took them, I think 4 months to get. So they're like 1,000 miles away from where they're living, going into Jerusalem. Not knowing really what they're going into. Knowing it's going to be hard, and they've kind of heard. But remember, most of these people traveling have never even seen Jerusalem. So they're really going into no man's land. They have no idea what they're going into.
Jill?
Yeah.
There's a fine line with what you were saying about the suggestion of church. I teach piano lessons to a lot of young children, and a lot of them ask me, you know, about church. Or, you know, they talk to me a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of them don't go to church. You know, they don't know about it. They're curious. And I find it so sad because, you know, it's important to me, and, I want to share that with them. But there's a fine line because you don't want them going back and telling their mom and dad, you know, she's talking to me about church. You know, they might not like that, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
Just... it's sad. So many of them don't go to church.
I think we have to change our paradigm about that. Because for some reason, well, here, I can tell you one reason. One reason is it takes the burden off us, right?
Right. Yeah.
Now we don't have to have this relationship. It's like, if I just bring them to church, church can take care of them.
Right, yeah.
What Ezra and Nehemiah is talking about is community and relationship and being with. So all these things that we've been building up to, this is what's happening here. They don't have a church to go to. They don't have a temple to go to. Mm-hmm. They're building one. And they're building it through relationship and actually through everyday stuff, which is what we'll see in the next chapter. So we go into chapter 3, and it starts out with, remember, they get to Jerusalem. Or they get to Judah, I should say. And it was a province of Persia at this time. It's called Yehud. And they go to all the cities that they were from, that their descendants were from. So maybe they remember Grandpa saying, you know, we were from, Bethlehem, or we were from Tirzah, or wherever. So they start going there and populating there. But then it says, what's the beginning of Ezra 3? Somebody read that.
First verse?
Yep.
Now when the seventh month came, and the sons of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem.
Okay. So the seventh month, that's the month of Tishri. It is a really important month for them because three of their big festivals happen. And so they know, remember, Torah's been taught in Babylon, and they have celebrated somewhat those in recognition, but they can't make sacrifices, which is the center of them celebrating. But they know about it. So although they're spread out now, they're in Judah, and they're trying to start settling, it's the seventh month, and they know they all have to meet up in Jerusalem because it's time for the feasts. So we would have some of the big feasts. We would have Day of Atonement, big. And we would have the Feast of Booths, or Sukkoth. So we would have these, and they knew they had to come. So they come together. They gather together in Jerusalem as one. Notice that. So you're going to notice throughout Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai, it's all about the unity of community, of gathering together as one. And they come there knowing that worship is actually going to be essential for them. They've come here to build the temple so that they can worship and have that access to God's presence so that that can be the center of their lives.
So how long have they been in the area? I kind of lost track here.
So right now it's just the seventh month.
Right.
And it will, I can't remember if it's 2 years there. I think it's about 2 years that they've been around there. But that will come up actually in just a little bit as they build the foundations.
It's not quite 2 years, I don't
think. No, it's not quite 2 years yet. Not quite, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they come, and the first thing.
It's their first year,
right. So it's almost a year, yep. And then there's going to be some space between this first event and then the building of the foundation. What we need to see is that this is the purpose of them actually coming to Jerusalem. The purpose is so that they would center around God, that they would reestablish God as their center. They need to address, God's been addressing their heart, and now they're coming and saying, yep, it is about our heart being centered on God. Because we are God's models. We are his image bearers. We're supposed to be the ones that reflect what it's like to be a whole image bearer. And we can only do that when we are directly in God's presence, when we are facing him, when our orientation of all of life is facing God, centering on him. That we are naming God's worth, that we're tending to his name being flourishing and having space to flourish. That's who we are, who we're all about. So they know that they're addressing, right now, we're physically going to do this. We're going to physically come. And here's one thing we need to understand. When we talk about worship, because that's what we're talking about here, all of Ezra 3. When we talk about worship, of course we have this very stilted idea of worship. What do we think worship is? I mean,
singing
before a sermon, right? We think that's worship. Such an odd idea that we would get that. Worship is a physical manifestation of submission. I don't care what you're worshiping, it is a physical manifestation of submission. So for them to come together for the express purpose of worshiping is saying physically, we are coming together as one body to say, we are in submission to you, Lord. You are our center. And when they come together, they also not just address their individual hearts, but they're addressing the heart of themselves. And they're saying, our relationships, the way we connect one another, is also centered around God being the center of life and restoration. That's really different than how we mostly establish relationships, right? How do we usually establish relationships?
Common interest.
Common interest, right? Oh, you like to bike and I like to bike? Okay, let's go biking.
But you as the center.
But me as the center.
Right?
Exactly.
What I like to do.
What I like to do and you like to do? Okay, yeah, we can connect. But what God is saying and what's happening here is the center of your relationships now is also oriented toward God being the restorer, for God being the source of life. And I know that all of you have both. The relationships that you have that are centered around that, right? Where you really, you're iron sharpening iron. You're talking about what's God doing in your life and helping one another work those out. Those relationships, as opposed to the normal relationship we have that are with people of interest. What's the difference between those relationships?
Vulnerability,
right? Huge, huge. I can be open with those people, right? Because I know that their interest is letting me see God restoring, right? And you come away from conversations of relationships like that, and you're just like, wow, it was so nice that somebody could see where God was restoring, and I couldn't. But relationships where they're only about interests, you know, the minute you get out of that interest, they get kind of tough, right?
Yeah,
like, and vulnerability is not going to happen there usually. So he's restoring not just individual hearts. And we so need to understand this because we are such an individualistic society. God is not trying to build up individuals coming to him. And that sounds really weird, but he's trying. His whole idea is to build a people. Because individuals that come to him aren't being restored. It's people coming to him. That's the restoration. If I stay only with God and me, again, it's not a reflection of him. So what they see this coming to Jerusalem is this is our purpose. Our purpose is to physically manifest that God is the center of our lives. I'm going to physically manifest that. I also see it, interesting enough, as a protection. Now, there's an interesting thing. There's an interesting verse here. A verse that says, because of the peoples of the land, they were terrified, and so they built the altar. Did anyone question that?
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem weird? They built the altar because they were terrified of the people.
Felt very transactional. Like, if we give you an offering. Will you protect us?
Okay, let's go back to the backstory, right? Why were they exiled out of Judah?
Because they weren't
intermingling. They were intermingling with the people, right? They weren't being an image because they were intermarrying with idolatrous people. They were completely assimilated into other places. Now, why were they terrified of the people and so they built an altar? They were terrified because that's still a temptation. Right? So what's the solution? Worship, right? Say, physically manifest right there. We got to build altars right now. Because we are so afraid that we are going to do the same thing that got us exiled in the first place. The only solution to not getting our hearts completely distorted there is to center and say, God, you are who you say you are. You are compassionate. You are this. I'm going to ascribe with you. I'm going to name you as worthy and available to us at all times. I'm going to name you, and that begins to prepare my heart for restoration, right? I cannot be prepared for restoration while I am not saying, God, you are the center of life. You are the source of all of my restoration.
Well, and doing it in community totally builds you up, yeah.
Doing community completely builds you up. Really helps one another, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, wait, there's all the temptation sitting out there. Let's go. Let's get to the center. Let's do it. And so they are adamant that they get and build that altar. And we see them. That's the first thing they do as soon as they get to.
Oh, my goodness. Jill, I was talking to Jen Curtin this week.
Uh-huh.
She was telling me this story that just came out in psychology or study about rats and this bottle that had water and this bottle that had crack, cocaine. And she was saying that they would put the rats by themselves. Yeah. And the rats would obviously get addicted to the cocaine and would continue to go to that bottle. But then when they put the rats in community, the rats may try the cocaine, but they would actually get off of it because of the pull of the community towards the water. And the community would go to the water, and it would get them dependent on water even in the presence of cocaine.
Yes.
And it was just so fascinating that by themselves, they just couldn't get to the water.
That's right.
You know?
Wow. That is the message of Ezra.
Yeah.
This is not an individualistic restoration. Mm-hmm. It can't be. We weren't made to be individuals. We were made to be Trinitarian in community. So it's really important that we understand that. And that we become aware of the fact that God is putting us in community all the time. And it may not be the community we would have chosen, right? It may not be the picture. I remember heading up a retreat. I'd been on the retreat committee, and then now I was going to head up for the second year. And, asking, was there anybody on that retreat committee that, wanted to be on my committee now? And, I could have picked almost all those people except one. There was just one person. I said, God, please don't let her want to be on my committee. Please. I just know, we just, rub each other. It just wouldn't be good. Well, of course she ended up being on my committee. And here's the thing. Toward the end, when things get really hairy, which is where Janet is right now, things are just like, oh, man, there's all sorts of things, and, we just need to go to prayer. Guess who was the only one who actually covered me, came with me into prayer, and we spent prayer time. It was that one. It was the one that I didn't want. It was the one that God put me in community with, right? Mm-hmm. Be aware that God's putting you in community with people that maybe you didn't choose, and maybe you wouldn't choose to go out to lunch with them. And you don't have to. It is God saying, I'm putting them here for a reason. And community is how you are going to be restored in this day here. It may only be for a season, but this community that I'm putting you in, this is what I'm giving you in restoration. I'm going to give you a hint here. I'm not going to tell you the whole thing, but I want you to see who the first people are to make the altar. And we have two people here, right? You know who they are?
Yeshua and Zerubbabel.
Yeshua and Zerubbabel, right? Yeshua and Jerubbaal. Okay, Yeshua, obviously, some of your translations will say Joshua. That's the Englishized version. It's Yeshua. It's the same name as Jesus. And then we have Jerubbaal. So we have two of these people that are kind of, they're the instigators of, and they say at the beginning, you'll see them in Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai. You'll see them all over the place. You'll see them in Ezekiel. You see them everywhere. So we were going to begin to give you little hints of, like, what are they doing here? Because it's about community. Yeshua, Jesus, is, what's his job? Who is he? He's the high priest. He's actually the grandson of the last high priest that was in the temple. Jerubbaal, what's his job?
Yeah, built the altar.
But doesn't it say who he is?
He's a royal son person.
Does it say who?
One of the sons of Solomon.
Okay. He is actually the governor here. It seems that Jerubbaal and Yeshua have come together under Persian rule, and Persia has allowed this for them to come together and be the rulers, like the religious ruler and the civic ruler. Okay, coming together. Yeah, so Zerubbabel, as you will eventually find out, is actually in the line of David, and he's actually the grandson of the last Davidic king before they were exiled. So we have this Davidic king, and we have this high priest. And together, you will see them always together, and they're kind of this leading people. They build the altar, but then notice that it's all the community that comes alongside and begins to build the temple. So we begin to see, like, oh, what is this foreshadowing for us? Mm-hmm. What we see is the altar is now available for them to begin to give sacrifices. And remember, burnt offerings, day and evening. Burnt offerings are the essential offering that must be given for anyone to come into the presence of God. Remember, it's always, there has to be an offering to come in, and it's the burnt offering, and it's morning and evening. Whenever you see in Scripture the two extremes, Alpha and Omega, morning and evening, what it means by that is all. So when it says they sacrificed morning and evening, it covered all of life. Okay, so it wasn't just morning, it only lasted, and then nighttime, and then they had to do it again. It's a literary device to say, it's all of life. It covers all of life so that we now have access all the time to worship. So to be aware that we manifest God as our center, to be aware that worship is actually our purpose, that worship protects us, and that I think that's a big concept, that worship protects us from the temptation of finding fulfillment elsewhere. Mm-hmm. If we know that, then we begin to understand. But remember again, please, and I don't know how to disabuse us of the idea of what worship is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we just need a whole day on, you know, reviving our idea of what worship is. Because worship happens all the time, every day. And no matter what you're doing, it's practicing the presence of God. That sounds like a good book title. Practicing the presence of God. And if you know that book, I mean, it is an old book by Brother Lawrence, really little, great devotional to just hit around. It talks about this man who wasn't up to par to be a full monk. So he becomes a brother, and he learns how to practice God's presence while peeling potatoes. And he learns it so well that people come all over the place to be in his presence as he peels potatoes. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in the presence of someone who literally practices being in the presence of God, that it exudes. I've had that experience twice. And there's nothing, like, you can't even explain what that looks like. But it is someone who literally, their life is so centered on God that it literally, it's like Moses, like the face shining. It just comes out. That's who they're about. They're not about anything else. Yeah. that's what he's talking about. Be aware that that is where you're going toward. In order to be aware, though, we do need to engage. So there's always this awareness of seeing, but if you don't do anything with the sight, you've lost it, right? So you've got to engage. So you actually have to enter the rhythm that they were providing with the worship. So God says, worship is your protection. Worship is your purpose. Well, then enter into the rhythm of worship. Establish a routine where you are recognizing the gifts of the hope of restoration, the gift of community, and the gift of worship. And this actually has to be, I wanted so much to give you something to be able to do it, but this has to be personal. It has to be your routine. You actually have to commit to being very intentional about a routine to remind me. So I had a pastor who used to say his routine to remind him that he was in God's presence was every time he came to a stop sign when he was driving, he would see it as stop to offer praise. It was, oh, I need to worship here. I need to worship here. So maybe something like that. It may be just putting a note up on your mirror somewhere that says, this is restoration. I'm going to enter this. Or whatever you need to say to yourself. It may be just a little, I want to say icon, and that carries connotations for people they don't like. A little, you know, just a little something. I have, Rob, in your Lego thing, I found a pig. And I felt a pig could not be in the altar, so I took him out. But the pig has been sitting over there. So it's just a tiny little pig, and he's so cute. But it reminds me that God actually is restoring the uncleanness, right, to make it clean. Because in the New Testament, we have pigs being okay, right?
Bacon's good,
yeah, yeah. But so something like that, to have a little piggy there that says, oh yeah, God's restored me. This is restoration. He's making me into something that is clean rather than unclean. So my challenge to you is find something, a picture, words, a little farm animal, something that reminds you that today you're in the middle of restoration. And that it is because God loves you and is bringing you to look like who you were made to be. Yeah. Find something that is in the middle of restoration or needs restoring or is fully restored. Find something. Next week I'm going to ask you what you found, whether it was a picture or words or whatever. But you need to wrestle through this so that it becomes yours. If I give you all a little pig, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to do much for you. It will sit like all the rest of the stuff I give you in what cabinets or whatever. You need to come up with something. That's engaging in worship. Because when you see that, then you need, oh, that's right, God is restoring me. God, you are where I'm getting life. You are. I'm going to say that. So I'm going to ask, where are you restoring me? But I'm also going to say, you are restoring me. You are giving me life. Hmm.
So
yes.
I understand that needs to be personal because that's how it becomes consistent, because it's something that means something to us.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also learning, you know, there isn't growth or restoration or anything without us being in community. Like,
mm-hmm.
We have to do it together.
Yeah.
So is that, I mean, how we would do it is, you would ask us next week.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what I want to ask you next week. And it might be really helpful for you to start talking about that, you know, with other people. Like, you know, what, because it'll click with you, right? We see other people's stuff and we think, oh, yeah, that would really click with me. That reminds me of restoring. Maybe something from your past, you know.
But it flourishes because we do it,
yes,
as a community,
as together.
Wait, isn't that the point of liturgy?
That's the point of liturgy. That's the whole point of liturgy.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, for me to keep my little pig up there and not say anything to anyone, first of all, I'll forget. And I will have no one to remind me. Oh, that's right. God's restoring you. There's your little piggy. You know? That's helpful. And it's helpful to actually put it out there and kind of, you know, sometimes I've given you stuff like, hang on, how many of you have Thy Kingdom Come? So some of us have on our rear view mirrors, right? I actually, it's the one thing I got out of my car when it was totaled. I actually took that out and put it on the new car.
I have
a Mizzou. You have your Mizzou? Yeah. Those are things that help us. We're concrete people, and it just helps us to reorient. I'm going to put my face toward God's face.
Jill.
Yeah.
I think it's important to change that symbol out.
I agree.
Because it can become part of the background.
I agree. Yeah. Right. And which is why God actually brings us into little exiles all the time, right? So I agree that that's true. That's true. I know that we're way over, so I'm going to stop here. Let me pray, and then we'll talk about work next week, I hope. Father, I thank you for the time that we've had in your presence. I mostly thank you that you are faithful to restore us, that you use every piece of our history and every piece of our present to restore us to your image. I pray that this week we would have that hope so clear, that we would be more aware of the backstory of not only our lives, but of the lives of those around us, that we might join in community and encourage one another and be with one another to empathize and to encourage. Might we celebrate, most of all, the constant access we have to worship you, to say you are indeed the only source of life, and the ability to do that together, to encourage one another, and to have our hearts ready for the next step of restoration. You are such a good and loving God. In his name we pray. Amen.